In a moment, Richard C. Hoagland joins us. We're going to talk about all things NASA and this incredible possibility of microbial life found on Mars. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, just when I think I've given him enough time to sit back and take a little break, another major story breaks in the world of science. So it's time to wheel in Richard C. Hoagland from the EnterpriseMission.com. Hey, Richard, how are you?
Well, it's a dark and stormy night here in New Mexico, George. You may lose me. We're having a major thunderstorm over the Sandia Mountains. I'm looking outside, and it's like they're all lit up with electric lights.
Is this unusual for this time of year there?
It has been in the last few years. This is the monsoon season where we get the storms off the Gulf because of the airflow, and we've got a lot of moisture in the air this week. And tonight we're having amazing rolling thunderstorms. I can see on the radar they're marching across from east to west, and about every hour we get drenched. So it's going to be pretty interesting to see whether we can go through the whole hour with me sticking around.
Tomorrow, Friday,
yes,
a fellow boy the name of Yoop. Hoot Hoopa. Am I close to that?
close enough for folk music.
The University of Gießen in Germany is supposed to say something about the possibility of life on Mars.
You know, George, this is a most intriguing story because as soon as he came out with his paper, him and a co-author from the University of Washington, they were smacked down by a guy named Norman Pace, who's a microbiologist at the University of Colorado, under the employ of NASA, of course. NASA does not want anybody thinking there's anything alive on Mars. And it's interesting that all these breakthroughs come from people that are not associated with NASA or working at foreign universities, certainly not working under NASA grants. And what makes this story so interesting, and I'll be really intrigued to see what happens tomorrow when it's formally published, is that it's the next shoe from a previous story that I went back and traced to 2001 by another non-NASA scientist named Joseph Miller, who is a specialist in cell biology and neurobiology at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. Now, let me start with that story, and then we'll move back up to the German story.
Okay.
The Miller story, which came out in 2001, was basically that Miller was kind of a fan of the Viking mission and was a friend or a colleague, anyway, of Gil Levin, who was one of the principal investigators on the original Viking spacecraft biology experiments, started looking at some data on the web through the NASA National Space Science Data Center one day and noticed some very peculiar things in Levin's published data. Levin's experiment consisted basically of feeding potential Martian microbes in the soil samples, something they called chicken soup. It basically was a organic compound rich in various, you know, things that microbes love to eat. And when the sampler brought the soil into the Viking spacecraft, what they did is they, by computer, dumped this liquid nourishment on the soil to see if anything would grow.
I see. All right.
And there were three separate, similar sets of experiments looking at different chemical reactions that are the byproduct of life in the two Viking landers that set down in the summer of 1976, what I've called the Viking summer. Anyway, so 30-some years later, Miller is looking at this data, and he notices from his background in neurobiology, which has to do with human brain waves and all that, he notices a peculiar rhythm in the graphs from Levin's 1976 biology experiment. He sees little peaks and valleys, and it turns out the peaks and valleys have a periodicity of 24.66 hours, which is the daily rotation rate of Mars. And these peaks and valleys in the output from the graphs, telemetered back to Earth millions of miles away, went on for 9 weeks after the initial experiment was initiated, when the chicken soup was dumped on the soil in the Viking lander. And the conventional explanation was that, oh, the activity that was seen initially was simply chemistry, that some kind of reaction between hydrogen peroxide in the reddish soils of Mars was reacting with the water in the, quote, chicken soup, and causing a chemical reaction that was mimicking life.
So no big deal to them at the time.
That's right. And NASA said, oh, there's nothing there. Go away. You know, move on by. Nothing to see. Nothing to see. Well, this guy, Miller, later looked at this and he said, wait a minute, guys. This is like 30 years after. He said, how could you get from a simple chemistry reaction? Because what chemistry does is that it basically gobbles up all the available stuff, and there should be no chemistry left to react, right, after the initial event?
Right.
This, whatever it was, went on for 9 weeks, and it had this wonderful up, down, up, down, up, down, like the little microbes with the circadian rhythm of the Mars day, which is 24.66 hours.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Looked like they were breathing.
Yeah.
They were metabolizing. So now we fast forward the film to this story by our friend from Germany, who basically says, based on his completely separate analysis of the other experiment on the Viking lander, he thinks there could be little beasties in the soil.
And he calls them weird beasties.
Weird beasties, because instead of using the normal chemistry of life on Earth, they use hydrogen peroxide as part of their metabolizing solution. Instead of water, they use a saturated form of hydrogen peroxide, which would have the advantage that it's a really cool antifreeze, and it would allow chemistry, biological chemistry, to proceed at like 60 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, which, of course, any organisms from Earth would be frozen solid. So when you put these two things together, George, tomorrow could be a really interesting day, because that's what science is. It's separate guys looking at separate data coming to similar results, having not compared notes.
He says that 0.1% of the Martian soil could be of biological origin, and he says that's not a small amount.
No, that's about the equivalent of biology going on in the soils in the Antarctic here on Earth.
That's incredible. I mean,
well,
now, but now you said earlier, I mean, here we go. NASA's sending the Phoenix Mars lander. It's going to hit there May of 2008. It's going to probe the soil near the North Pole looking for life. Why do you say they don't want this known? Is it because of the Phoenix lander?
No.
It would take away the hoopla from that? Why?
No, look, you have to separate the scientists who are basically honest guys looking for what they say they're looking for.
Do I hear thunder in the background?
That's the mountains ringing with thunder here in New Mexico.
Okay.
You know, actually, I have the sound effects record on.
Exactly. You're probably in some mansion somewhere.
Anyway, you got to separate the science from the politics. Remember, if I'm right, if what Mike and I have put in this book, Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA, is right, there's a huge hidden agenda on the part of the political system that gave us NASA, separate from the scientists, the honest folks. Remember, I've always said that most of the agency is filled with honest folks, right? When Gil Levin tried to get attention for his claim that his experiment on Viking had found life on Mars, NASA made his life a living hell, George. They not only didn't do anything to support his data, but they went around and attacked his credibility. They attacked his reputation. They attacked how he had prosecuted the experiment, how he conducted the analyses. They did everything but basically, you know, have him abducted.
Well, the German scientist is already being attacked, as you said, because Pace, this microbiologist at the University of Colorado, simply says, this sounds bogus to me.
Yeah, and the fact is he doesn't have a lick of evidence as to why is it bogus? Because he's using as his criteria terrestrial life? Is it possible you go to an alien planet, particularly one that suffered the bizarreness of Mars, and you find an indigenous life form that is operating differently than Earth?
Absolutely. You know, and also they said today that it's possible that all the oceans and the water on Mars, aside from that which may have seeped down below, of course, might have been blown off the planet by solar by windstorms.
Well, that's one possibility. The other possibility, of course, is the catastrophe for Mars that Mike and I wrote in our paper titled Mars, we published on the web several years ago at enterprisemission.com, because there we have a major catastrophe in that Mars was a satellite, a la Tom Van Flandern, orbiting peacefully this other planet in what's now known as the asteroid belt. And one day, this other planet has the inconvenience of blowing up in the face of Mars.
A couple years ago, I was talking to the astronomer Philip Plate, whom I like.
You're good old Phil, yes.
And you know what? I think you like him as a person. You just don't get along with him views-wise.
Well, I like him as an astronomer. It's just when he ventures out of his depth and doesn't do his homework, and he will not I would love to talk with Philip as adult to adult about these things on this program with this audience, because I think we could provide a lot more light than heat on a number of issues. And, you know, Plate won't do it.
Well, okay. But anyway, what we talked about was my theory that everything in the universe is basically the same. The soup is the same. So if you find these microbes in Martian soil, even though they seem to be breeding in hydrogen peroxide, they're basically pretty similar to what you might find on Earth and what might be on other planets throughout this universe, which tells me that life eventually is going to end up like us.
Well, do you know that we have life forms on Earth that use hydrogen peroxide as part of their living process?
Wouldn't surprise me.
There are beetles. There's a beetle called the bombardier beetle. The Latin name is Bronchinus creptans, which uses a 25% solution of hydrogen peroxide to basically fire a steam bullet and knock down prey and keep predators at bay. So if life on Earth, in this pampered environment for life, could create an organism, a very complex organism like a beetle, that can use a 25% solution of this caustic compound called hydrogen peroxide, which Pei says, oh, will kill bacteria instantly. Well, yeah, if they were designed like Earth bacteria. But I think you're right, George. I think the DNA is the code. But there are so many trillions of possible combinations of things that DNA can code for that if you have the right environment, I think that this German scientist and his colleague are on the right track, because I go back to Miller. Miller's data is completely separate.
Yeah, that's a good
Everybody
point.
Out there, ask yourself what could have caused a biological type of reaction keeping pace exactly with the Martian day over 9 weeks after the initial injection of the chicken soup in that soil sample.
Shuttle Endeavor, land safely, thank God.
It
was tense.
Mea culpa. I was wrong. I am so glad I was wrong.
Wait a minute. You didn't say anything was going to happen.
I believe in admitting when I'm wrong. What I am intrigued with is that there's a huge internal review now as to the decisions that led to launching with brackets that could create ice. And one of the inadvertent things that they discovered as part of the review is that after the Columbia disaster, when they were returning the spacecraft to flight, they added an hour in the countdown when they filled the tanks with hydrogen and oxygen, which is inside that big thermos bubble covered with the foam, which is why the foam is there,
right,
to keep the air from supercooling on the outside and forming ice. They added an hour to the count so they could have what's called an ice team. There's a team of experts, NASA people, personnel, that go and basically walk around up and down the gantry and the ladders and the take photographs and look for ice. Well, that was a good idea. It was a positive idea to do. That extra hour, George, they're now thinking, may have been enough window for the ice to form that they really don't want to form in the first place. So it shows you how a good idea can become a bad idea because you don't understand all of the unintended consequences.
Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment with Richard C. Hoagland. We're going to talk about NASA Administrator Mike Griffin and what he's got up his sleeve with regards to going back to the moon or not. We're also going to take your phone call, so we'll give you the numbers in just a moment. And we'll be back with Richard C. Hoagland, author of the upcoming book, along with Mike Barra, Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA, which already, by the way, is on Amazon.com pre-sales. And it's selling pretty well. Well, we're changing the world of Mr. Al Bielek of the Philadelphia Experiment. He's getting a donation from us for every After Dark newsletter sold or renewed. And in addition to that, you are getting the classic Art Bell interview with Al Bielek on the Philadelphia Experiment. So to subscribe, simply call 1-888-727-5505 or go online, coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with this hour. Richard C. Hoagland with us. We're going to take your phone calls in just a moment. Richard, the NASA head, Mike Griffin, is he or is he not going to work on plans to get man back to the moon?
You know, George, before we get to that, I want to say something. I've been following your campaign for Al Al Bielek.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really admire you for that. The thing that Art started with this program, this is unlike any other radio program on Earth. The people that appear and the people who listen are part of what I have called and you've called and Art's called the Coast family. Mm-hmm. And it is so gratifying in this day of ruthless cynicism and expedient commercialism and blatant political spin doctoring to see someone actually, you know, walking their walk and to see what you're doing for Al, who I must say, when I heard Al in the beginning, I was incredibly skeptical about what he reported on and his experiences. And the farther I've gotten into the physics and the whole hyperdimensional model and, you know, looked at some of the work of people like Jack Sarfati, who I think is going to be a guest on your show in a few days,
Yeah. And
he talks about retrocausality. But we're seeing in some of the Russian data that I've talked about in the physics, this whole idea that future events can affect the present. We see it in the Princeton, you know, stuff that was going on with 9/11, where 4 hours before the awful tragedy, the Princeton eggs were going crazy over something. So the idea that you're remembering an important member of the Coast family and reaching out to him and involving all the rest of the family, well, I have a couple of words to say about that in Dark Mission, and I look forward to having you someday read it.
Okay, I shall. Of course, you know I will. Let's get a quick Mike Griffin comment from you, and we'll take some phone calls. Are we going back to the moon or not, Richard?
Well, we don't know tonight. Beginning a few months ago, Griffin was making noises that it was not going to happen on his watch. You know, he was the newly appointed 2 years now into his tenure as the head of NASA by President George Bush, who in 2004 enunciated at NASA headquarters this grand new vision for space exploration, which was, you know, no more shuttle, no more building space station after 2010, basically, you know, back to the moon and then on to Mars. Well, with some new recent developments coming out of headquarters, both in terms of inside information as well as public comments, it's looking now like Dr. Griffin is given up on basically going back to the moon with the new Orion spacecraft and the Ares boosters and all that.
Which he called Apollo on steroids a few years ago.
That's what he called it, Apollo on steroids. And he's leaving that as a decision for the next president, whoever he or she might be. And there are some of us who are very disappointed because we're seeing decisions that are being made, which if they had accelerated the timetable even a bit and been a little more hard-nosed about this awful shuttle. I mean, every time this thing lands, I cross my fingers, George, because it's, as you know, it's a walking accident.
Well, I know. As we were talking about earlier, I mean, every time it launches,
yep.
And we're worried.
And there's such a thing as is cost-to-benefit ratio. It's like how much effort and how much money of the limited amount of money that NASA gets every year. I mean, NASA gets nothing compared to the Department of Defense, you know, Homeland Security, Health and Human Services. NASA is basically operating on pennies in terms of the federal budget, and that is priceless money to be spent on pushing back the frontier and finding out what's really out there. You know, it basically is how long are we going to put up with the shuttle, and it now looks like the shuttle program has so impinged on the plan to go back to the moon that Dr. Griffin has thrown up his hands and basically said it's not going to happen during this administration, and if we really change philosophies with the next president, which is very possible, we may never get back to that.
Well, how disappointing. The Chinese will go. To the phones we go. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Richard C. Hoagland.
Hello?
Hi, go ahead.
Without getting into a lot of detail, I think I'll email Richard with the scriptural verses that apply. But I just wanted to ask him, has he ever given any thought to the fact that Mars may have been the original Eden? Because it talks about man being locked out and the angels setting guard to make it basically inhospitable for man to live there any longer. And then there's the tale of, you know, the war in the heavens. And it says that God created the earth, but he doesn't say, and then it says separately that he created a garden east in Eden. And then after the fall, Adam was locked out of there with no possibility of returning. And I just always wondered, with all of the discovery of, you know, that there was life on Mars at one time, with the monuments, etc., if it is, if he had ever considered that it may have been the original Eden.
You know, it's funny because you're telepathic, because this is something I've been thinking about for many years. And of course, I'm a data kind of guy, so I want to find evidence to support, you know, the text. But I think you're onto something. If we used to be so much more incredible and magnificent than we think we are now, and that some of the references in Genesis are to places we used to live that were not here on Earth, and things we could do when we were in God's grace, so to speak, then yes, I could make a case that you're absolutely right, that Sidonia was in fact Eden, and that big face, which is saying something about Homo sapiens, something about our human genesis. You know, Mike Heiser and I have these debates all the time, because he is of the opinion that this is probably not what could go on, and yet other Christians I've talked to think that, in fact, this might have been what went on, and the only way we're ever going to know is to go back and find out.
Thanks for that. It's great, the perspective. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead. Where are you calling from?
San Diego.
All right, take it away.
My name is Ladd. I'm in San Diego, and I've been trying to talk to Richard for years, but I finally got in.
You finally made it, Ladd.
My question, Mr. Hoagland, is back in 1969, I think, Apollo 17, is that the year?
1972 was the last mission.
Okay, 1972. On the mission, there was the rover camera panning out across the moonscape, and they saw something go poof, and it was a geyser. And they waited for a long time again, keeping the camera focused on the one spot. And it was, they said, yes, it is a geyser. So what do you remember about that?
Well, I remember they had something that came very close and almost hit the rover. When you see the pictures in Dark Mission, we have 250 astonishing photographs from NASA that show ruins of every imaginable description on and arching above the lunar surface, and we can confirm they're real because the same images are on the web, and we're going to give you the basic photographic number and the websites where you can corroborate. It's possible that something fell out of the rafters, and I'm not using that as a metaphor, literally fell out of the dome arching over the Taurus Littoral Valley and almost hit the rover, and then that's what they saw, because it would have raised a cloud of dust. And if you're thinking that stuff cannot fall down from up above, but it has to come up from underneath, the instant interpretation could have been a geyser, but in fact, this may be the explanation. And when you see the photographs, you'll see why I really think that that could be the explanation. They're just absolutely astonishing.
Richard, you know that skull on Mars, not the CP3O-looking thing on the moon, but on Mars. What the heck do you think that is?
Well, you know, we haven't really done a show on that.
No. Why not?
At about the same time that we were presenting what we call C3PO, or Data's Head on the Moon.
On the Moon, right.
Which is described in great detail and analyzed in Dark Mission.
And that was an Apollo 17
photo. Apollo 17 in Taurus Littoral, in Shorty Crater, as a matter of fact. There came from a guy named Joseph Skipper, who is an independent researcher who's done some good work over the years, who found on one of the Spirit photographs, the rover, you know, tooling around on Mars in Gusev Crater, he found this photograph which looks like a basically very robust skull. And you and I have talked about this quietly, and I haven't wanted to say much publicly because, frankly, I was waiting for NASA to take another picture. Because if there's one, there should be more than one. And given what we think happened in Gusev with the overturning of the soil and the erosion due to water and all that, there should be more than one example. And I've been just waiting for another one to pop up. Given that this has been raised tonight, I will say that it looks incredibly real. It looks like it was a real, massively boned and reinforced cranium lying there on the Martian sands. And now, of course, you forced me to actually go and put the photograph up on the Enterprise mission website.
You're going to have to. I mean, it looks not human, but close.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It isn't a spitting image of us. It's what you'd expect of something that was parallel, alien, but maybe related distantly, as I've been saying, in the model.
And it really does.
And
adaptable to its own environment.
Precisely.
Let's move.
So we'll, we'll put it up on, I'll tell you what, we'll put it up on darkmission.net.
Now, that's for the book, right?
That's for the book. But the book covers Moon and Mars. It covers the rovers, it covers spirits, so it belongs there.
Definitely.
And that's going to be our more speculative website, where we keep Enterprise more for science that we can really prove, whereas Dark Mission is basically what's in the new book.
Okay, definitely put that picture up. It's worth seeing. Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hi. Hello? Mike from California.
Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hi there. Richard, you have your fifth edition Alignments of Mars on me, but I need your question for this, or answer, I should say. The shuttle program, I've been watching this shuttle program since its early days when I was young, and it seems to me like NASA is not sure what they want to do after the shuttle program is ended, because every time when I hear something from NASA, it seems like they're just really kind of vague about what the program is going to be.
Well, Mike is correct. What is the follow-up to the shuttle program?
Well, we're supposed to have a booster to lift a new spacecraft, a Apollo-type capsule called the Orion, you know, crew exploration vehicle, from Earth's surface into Earth orbit that will do two things. It'll go back to the space station to allow us to ferry Americans to and from the space station, and then it will also form the nucleus of a system that would go on to the moon. You would rendezvous this crew exploration vehicle, basically an Apollo capsule on steroids, with a newly developed lunar lander, like the lunar module that Grumman built for the Apollo program, you know, 30, 40 years ago, but a brand new one built with much higher capabilities, able to land more cargo, able to take four astronauts to the moon instead of just two, things like that. And part of the program is speculative in that it isn't even funded. The part that has been funded, unfortunately, the engineers that are outside of NASA are looking at this and they're saying, well, wait a minute, it won't work. The booster is too light. The spacecraft is too heavy. You can't lift that into orbit, let alone send it to the moon. So this has caused a great deal of consternation among some of the contracting agencies like Lockheed Martin and Boeing and Northrop Grumman, which basically would like to see NASA do something that can be done within budget and get on with the program. And the problem is we've got this shuttle program as an albatross around our necks, because until they get rid of the shuttle, we're spending billions and billions of these precious dollars on a system that's obsolete, that's going to be basically put out to pasture in 2010, to build a space station whose purpose, whose raison d'etre now, is really up for grabs, because it doesn't fall in the main line of what you would do if you wanted to start over and do something that really would get you back to the moon and then on to Mars. So we're kind of hung up in this political dilemma that we're forced, because of our international partners, to spend money on two systems that don't really directly affect going to where the action is. Because when you read what is in Dark Mission, you'll see a stunning set of extraordinary intelligent artifacts that Apollo found on the moon and kept secret. And, you know, George, we have to mention the Wikipedia thing.
Oh, yeah. So, go ahead.
This fits right perfectly. Well, you know, there's this Caltech genius, whose name I forget, who came up with a wiki scanner that allows ordinary folks to basically track down who is editing Wikipedia entries. You know, Wikipedia is this general-purpose encyclopedia,
yep,
that's supposed to be so democratic, and everybody gets a chance to right the wrongs and correct the errors and all that.
Or wrong the rights.
Or wrong the rights, because it turns out that in the federal government, when they started looking at the entries and what was changed, the overwhelming agency, which is doing more futzing around with entries on Wikipedia than any other agency of the federal government, CIA, Homeland Security, Department of Defense, the number one agency with almost 7,000 changes is NASA.
They're doing editing, heavy
editing.
What
in the world are they spending their money, having bank upon bank of guys sitting there at keyboards futzing around with Wikipedia?
Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on the air with Richard Hoagland. Hi there.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Hoagland, it's an honor to speak with you. I'm proud to have Monuments of Mars in my library. Whenever I first heard you speaking with George about the robot head on the moon, it seemed like you were hinting that the Templars, when they were worshiping their severed head, that that's possibly what they were talking about. And the woman that called in earlier, speaking about our Genesis being on, possibly being from Mars,
mm-hmm.
there was a book, Martian Genesis, by Herbie Brennan. I just found it. It's kind of a piece of speculation, but he's got some interesting facts. And then just real briefly, there was a program on History of Discovery a long time ago that said that if we moved to Mars, we would all turn into basically giant white people with barrel chests and long white hair, like your comments.
Well, you know, there is a lot of speculation because in the absence of data, there's nothing to do but speculate. Fortunately, now we have science. We have the means of going to Mars. We have the means of sending men and women to Mars if we would get our act together. We certainly have extraordinary robots that are there. The rovers, by the way, have survived their Martian dust storm and are coming up the other side of the curve. It looks like they're going to live to rove another day. And if NASA would simply send them to interesting places, I mean, if you find one skull around where Spirit is roving, there's got to be more than one being unearthed by the eroding sands. If we're right, if Mars went through this huge catastrophe from a previous high-tech era of civilization and all kinds of other life forms, and then that catastrophe buried everything in miles of sediments and muds and debris, and then that stuff has been basically drying out for millennia, or if not millions of years, then it stands to reason that every once in a while, as you come across a sand dune, you're going to find a skull or maybe a whole torso or whatever. That's why I'm so intrigued with this Martian skull as the counterpart to the eerily anthropoid-looking robotic head that we found in the Apollo 17 data.
That is strange, too, though. But right, that one looks robotic. This yeah. other one looks biological.
Exactly. You can tell because the one, and there are close-ups in the book of these photographs, you can tell that the one on the moon is a robot because the eyes look like camera lenses. They look
yes.
like C-3PO.
Yes.
In fact, we have a side-by-side comparison. The thing on Mars looks organic, George. It looks like, in fact, you know what it looks like? It looks like a robust version of Neanderthal.
It looks like a cherub head to me.
Okay, the one I'm thinking...
You know how those little cherubs, how their little heads are squatty and small?
Yeah, but this has two very massive things around the collarbone. Remember
yeah,
that?
Yeah, now can you, when you post this on darkmission.net, can
yep.
you put a close-up?
Of course.
Okay.
Yeah, we do, and, you know, we'll do in the hands.
Hey, very briefly, you've got a conference coming up where?
San Francisco, September 15th, 16th, 17th. It's called the Wisdom Festival. I'm going to give a preview of Dark Mission with the photographs, amazing photographs. I'm going to try to figure out a way to sign book plates for people who pre-order from Amazon.com and can prove that they pre-ordered the book. You'll get up close and personal. I'll say something nice. I'll answer your questions. If you don't have a computer, you can call them at 415-452-0369. That's 415-452-0369, or look for Wisdom Festival on the web and at Enterprise and at Dark Mission, and we will basically show you some things you will not believe your friendly local neighborhood space agency has not been sharing with you for the last 40 years.
Very good. Richard C. Hoagland, thanks for the Martian soil update. Microbial life. Maybe.